strategy. Not only has Starbucks been firing vocal union leaders like the Memphis Seven, like Layla in Arizona, like Kessie Fleischer and others in Buffalo, but they've been slashing hours across the country to try to purge everyone and force everyone to quit or have to get other jobs, and then telling them, oh, suddenly your availability doesn't meet the needs of the business. If we, the only... this is all showing just how much we need a union, because, you know, together we can fight back against all of these things.
Jasbir Zak, we want to thank you for being with us. Barista at the Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, the first location in the U.S. to unionize with Starbucks Workers United. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Anna Osbeck, Maria Inez Terracena, Mary Conlin, and David Prude. We have a job opening for a news writer-producer. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the return of Portland Folk Music Society concerts with artists who tour nationally. The series continues this month on Saturday, April 16th, with guitarist Pat Donahue. Portland Folk Music Series has one show every month through June. The concerts will be at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, surprising April snow in Portland might not be a result of climate change, the ACLU of Oregon weighs in on the Portland Police Bureau audit, and a suspect is detained in the Brooklyn subway shooting. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Snow has been recorded in downtown Portland at least six times during the month of April. Some are questioning whether this week's snowstorm is an indication of climate change, but global warming trends make that possibility unlikely. Late season snowstorms have actually become less common as the climate has gotten warmer. On April 1st, 1936, just over 5 inches of snow were recorded in downtown Portland. An inch and a half of snow was recorded on April 7th, 1933, and there was a tenth of an inch of snow recorded during the month of April in 1895, 1901, and 1903. This week did mark the first time snow has stuck in downtown Portland in the 80-plus years the National Weather Service has been keeping records. Nonetheless, Oregon State climatologist Larry O'Neill said, quote, "I think the real story here is that we used to get snow more often in April in Portland, and now we don't," end quote. He called the storm typical weather variability and not a sign of climate change. Lowland snow is becoming less frequent as the climate is warming. Lowland snow is typical during La Niña, a Pacific Ocean weather pattern that creates and shifts cooler temperatures up north during the winter, while the south experiences warmer, drought-like conditions. Paul Leukith is an associate professor of geography at Portland State University. He agrees that the snowstorm did not have a strong connection to climate change. Leukith said, quote, It's kind of in the opposite direction of the way the statistics are going as far as warming temperatures. Aprils are warming in Portland. We're seeing, in general, less extreme cold over time, and that's projected to continue, end quote. We won't have a definitive answer on the potential relationship to climate change until a special analysis is conducted. Figuring out whether the snowstorm is a result of climate change involves running two weather models, which compare the likelihood of this event occurring in a pre-industrial climate to today's climate. On the other hand, the recent wildfires are examples of extreme weather events occurring because of climate change. Loykith said, quote, "Those impacts we've already felt, we can measure it. It's clearly connected," end quote. Portland police collected indiscriminate data and surveillance of people who participated in the 2020 racial justice protests, even when they weren't suspected of a crime. That's according to an audit of the Portland Police Bureau's tactics and internal practices that was released last week. Here's what the American Civil Liberties Union wrote of the audit. Quote, "Such indiscriminate, warrantless surveillance chills free speech, erodes trust between community and government, and creates alarming opportunities for abuse. That is why, under Oregon law, the police are prohibited from collecting and maintaining information on anyone's political views or activities outside of a criminal investigation. PPB's broad and highly intrusive surveillance of protesters in 2020 is a blatant violation of this law," end quote. I spoke with ACLU of Oregon staff attorney Rachel Dalal Gale to learn more about the impacts of this new information. So the PPB audit, how does it relate to work that the ACLU of Oregon has already done in relation to surveillance by the PPB?
Yeah, so this really just confirms a lot of what we already suspected and feared about PPB's surveillance capabilities. We've already successfully sued PPB over its live streaming surveillance of the 2020 protests. So we knew that to some extent this was happening. We didn't realize, however, the extent of it. And the audit report really dives deeper into the world of surveillance at PPB and reveals that this is a much more systemic issue than we had feared. So for instance, the audit report stated that PPB has 37 different surveillance technologies at its disposal. It unfortunately doesn't identify those for the public, but that feeds into our work in that now we know that that exists and that's an area that we pursue in the future in terms of requesting records and making those available for the public so that we can have increased transparency and accountability on this issue.
To your mind and in your experience, what should the PPB be doing to not violate the First Amendment protections of protesters? I know that's kind of an esoteric question, but this audit shows how, you know, freewheeling they are.
Right. So I think the audit really zeroes in on one of the main solutions here, and that is just increased internal accountability within PPB. So the audit identifies that there are pretty much no procedural guardrails in place to govern the use of these surveillance technologies or surveillance strategies. And that in itself is a problem because then it's down to individual officers on the ground making decisions in the moment without any guidance about whether and how to surveil protesters or anyone else, when really there should be guidance coming from the top, from management, in an informed way that takes into account our civil liberties and our legal protections that dictate when it is and isn't appropriate to use these technologies. And ideally that information would be public, it would be transparent, we would be able to hold people accountable to it. There would be input from attorneys who are aware of the law and able to counsel PPB about what is and isn't appropriate. So there's a whole system that I think should exist around these issues that simply doesn't. And that's gonna be a huge step, is making sure that that is eventually implemented.
And what does it mean when people say that something like this chills free speech? Why is that important to acknowledge and to fight back against?
So the First Amendment right to engage in free speech and political activity is really foundational to American democracy. And something that chills free speech is anything in terms of government action that might discourage people from being willing to exercise those rights. So if I'm a protester and I know that by going out and voicing my concern about, for instance, racial justice, I might end up on a PPB watch list or have my information collected for further surveillance down the line, that might make me a little more hesitant to engage in the kind of political speech that I'm entitled to. And that's what we consider a chilling effect. And that's really dangerous to our democracy because it stifles people's voices. And it discourages people from holding the government accountable on issues that are critically important to our society.
And that information that is collected about folks, you know, with no criminality involved, could that be used in court against them at some later point?
That's a really good question. No, I don't believe so. I think, you know, if PPB is collecting surveillance in a kind of indiscriminate, warrantless, dragnet kind of way, that evidence would be subject to challenge if it was brought up later. But it's still chilling. I mean, it's frightening to people to know that if they were to go out and attempt to exercise their First Amendment rights, that they might be watched, that that information might be kept in a dossier. And the fact that there are protections in place further down the line is not always encouraging to folks. So I think it's something we need to take really seriously from the beginning.
Right. You don't want it to come to that. Are there grounds for individuals who were surveilled or who think that they may have been surveilled to sue the PPB or to find that out for sure?
Yeah. So the first step, and one that we're really encouraging people to take, is to reach out to the city and request records. So if you were at the 2020 protests and you think that you might have been subject to this illegal surveillance, ask Portland and find out. See if they have any records about you. And if you find anything, reach out to ACLU. We have an intake form on our website. We would love to hear from you because there are steps you can take at that point.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just really encourage folks to continue the fight. I know it can be really discouraging. There's always information coming out about the city and about PPB that's disappointing, and it feels like there's very little progress made. But we need to let them know that we're still engaged. So again, if you believe that you've been surveilled illegally, reach out, request your records, and let us know what you find. We really want to help.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
That was ACLU Oregon staff attorney Rachel Dalal Gale speaking with me about the recent audit of the Portland Police Bureau that showed the indiscriminate surveillance tactics they used in the 2020 protests. The salmon fishing season's recent closure on the lower Columbia River could have devastating impacts for the rural communities that rely on that industry. Eric Tegedoff spoke with the executive director of the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, who says four lower Snake River dams in Washington are making it hard for salmon in the region to spawn.
The salmon fishing season on the lower section of the Columbia River was shut down a week ago, prompting folks to call for more action to save the fish. Bob Reese, head of the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, says the April 6th closure directly impacts rural communities in Oregon and Washington.
The industry that supports us and our families really represents one of the greatest transfers of wealth from urban to rural communities. Most of our clientele come from the cities. They want to come out and enjoy these beautiful rural settings along the lower Columbia River and have a chance at one of these prized salmon.
Many rural communities still are recovering from the pandemic. Reese notes that this time of year, sport fishing typically represents the only source of tourism for communities along the Columbia. Reese says as salmon travel up the Columbia into Idaho to spawn, four lower Snake River dams in southeast Washington turn the river into a series of warm water reservoirs that have reduced the numbers of wild salmon to a few hundred in some years. In turn, that reduces the number of meaningful fishing days people get.
Even though we are targeting hatchery fish only, the number of wild fish that come back to those spawning grounds directly dictates what our opportunity is to catch those hatchery fish.
Washington Senator Patty Murray and Governor Jay Inslee say they'll have an actionable plan on replacing the four lower Snake River dams by this July. Reese says it's the most encouraging movement he's seen working on this issue for the past two decades. But he warns solutions will have to come quickly if salmon species are going to survive in the region.
These fish don't have another two decades, so it needs to be something that is meaningful, and it needs to have the support of other elected delegates in the Pacific Northwest.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Police have arrested 62-year-old Frank R. James for yesterday's Brooklyn subway shooting that left 10 shot and another 13 injured. James became a suspect when police at the scene found keys to a U-Haul truck he had rented in Philadelphia. Inside the truck were a 9mm semi-automatic handgun and extended magazines, fireworks, a liquid believed to be gasoline, and detonated and undetonated smoke grenades. The gunman had released smoke grenades and fired 33 shots inside the subway car as it approached a station. James appears to have posted dozens of rambling videos on social media in recent years in which he has expressed a range of controversial views on topics going from mental health services, death, and race to Ukraine. In a video posted on April 6th on a YouTube channel belonging to user ProphetOfTruth88, he says there needs to be more mass shootings, claiming the problem wouldn't be the shooter, rather the environment they exist in. James was reportedly arrested in New York without incident after a 30-hour manhunt. At least 23 were injured in the New York City subway attack, and U.S. officials can't confirm social media reports of a chemical weapons attack in Mariupol. With more on these stories, we go to Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We would not allow New Yorkers to be terrorized, even by a single individual.
At least 16 people were injured in a mass shooting in a Brooklyn subway Tuesday. Witnesses say a man entered a train during the Tuesday morning rush, deployed a smoke canister, and began firing. In a video posted to Twitter, New York City Mayor Eric Adams, in quarantine after contracting COVID-19, thanked first responders who were on the scene after the attack.
You are what make New York the greatest city in the world, and I thank you for supporting your fellow New Yorkers.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul told reporters Tuesday she'd commit the full resources of the state to stopping future mass shootings.
And we say no more. No more mass shootings. No more disrupting lives. No more creating heartbreak for people just trying to live their lives as normal New Yorkers. It has to end, and it ends now.
Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby says U.S. military officials can't confirm reports that the Russian military used chemical weapons in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. The Guardian reports the claim was first made by Ukrainian forces holding the port city, and an unverified report was later posted to social media claiming city residents were suffering from respiratory failure.
Although I would add that the Russians have certainly proven more than willing to use chemical weapons when it suited them in the past.
As the U.S. embargo of Russian oil continues, President Joe Biden is lifting a summertime ban on higher ethanol gasoline blends. The White House says the move is a bid to keep prices at the pump under control heading into the summer travel season, but the New York Times reports its impact will likely be minimal. At a stop in Iowa to tout the plan Tuesday, Biden said the move would spur crop production across the Midwest. Corn is a primary ingredient in ethanol.
Knowing you have a buyer gives farmers something they don't often have: peace of mind, certitude about where their product can be sold and to get a fair price for it.
As of Tuesday, AAA said the average cost of a gallon of gas was $4.10. The State Department has released its 2021 Human Rights Report, which tracks human rights abuses across the globe. It comes as Russian troops face mounting allegations of war crimes in Ukraine. The report contains chapters on nearly 200 countries and territories, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken says it found human rights and democratic values have backslid in recent years.
Civil society, governments, and people around the world are rightly pointing out that Ukraine is, tragically, far from the only place where gross abuses are being perpetrated.
And inflation jumped by 8.5% over the past year, according to the latest numbers from the Department of Labor. That's the highest single-year spike since the early 1980s. According to Politico, the surge is being caused by, among other things, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, supply chain issues, and strong consumer demand. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview about how investors in the real estate market drive the housing crisis. At 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 34. Tomorrow has scattered thunderstorms and a high of 50. Today in history, in 1976, the U.S. Treasury reintroduces the $2 bill in honor of the 233rd anniversary of Thomas Jefferson's birthday in the United States Bicentennial Celebration. The quote of the day is from Jefferson, who said, quote, "I find friendship to be like wine, raw when new, ripened with old age, the true old man's milk and restorative cordial."
Thank you.
Yesterday, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Judy Chu of California sent a letter to the IRS and Treasury Department demanding the agency explain why audits of low-income taxpayers have doubled over the past year. As the IRS has seen its funding decline over the years, thanks to Republicans, the agency has increased its audits on the poorest Americans, especially those who qualify for the Earned Income Tax Credit, those who make less than $25,000 a year. This is largely because it's much easier and cheaper for the IRS to examine the finances of low-income taxpayers than to try to untangle the assets of the ultra-wealthy, as presented by their highly paid tax accountants. A recent analysis of IRS data by Syracuse University researchers found that low-income households making less than $25,000 a year were audited at five times the rate than all other taxpaying households in the fiscal year 2021. Warren and Chu's letter read, quote, "The most vulnerable taxpayers should not shoulder the burden of insufficient IRS enforcement funding simply because they require fewer resources to audit." The Florida legislature will allow Republican Governor Ron DeSantis to take the lead on redrawing the state's 28 congressional districts. In Florida, like most states, the state legislature proposes a redistricting plan that the governor either approves or rejects. DeSantis vetoed the GOP-controlled legislature's proposal on March 29th, offering his own map that would increase the number of GOP seats while eliminating two districts represented by Black Democrats. Legislative leaders wrote in a memo, quote, "We are awaiting a communication from the governor's office with a map that he will support." Representative Al Lawson, whose district is one of those eliminated under the governor's plan, said, quote, "The Florida legislature is caving to the intimidation of DeSantis and his desire to create additional Republican seats in Congress by eliminating minority access districts." Florida, Missouri, and New Hampshire are the last three states completing congressional districting. So far, according to the website 538, in the U.S. House, there are 181 Democratic-leaning seats, 182 Republican-leaning seats, and 34 highly competitive seats among the 435 seats in the U.S. House. Over 100 landmarks will be getting new names. Previously, they were called a derogatory term for Indigenous women. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Hundreds of geographic features and landmarks in the United States will soon have new names, including 28 sites in Wisconsin. Those sites currently hold the name of a derogatory term for Indigenous women. WXPR's Aaron Gottsacker spoke with a mother and daughter from the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, about what the change means to them.
Deanne Allen is used to hearing slurs slung her way because of her race. She went to Lakeland Union High School at the peak of the spearfishing controversy and was taunted by protesters and classmates alike.
It was always a negative, foul swear word type of thing that they were saying to bring you down.
A generation later, those derogatory terms haven't gone away. Allen's daughter, Kennedy Mayo, reports similar experiences.
Even in high school, like the areas up here, the schools I'd go to, and I'd be like slurred at in like the stands because I, you know, was so good, but also it was very obvious I was a Native, you know, player and a woman.
These jeers and slurs aren't just thrown about casually by high school rivals. They're written into the names of streets and lakes and creeks across Wisconsin. And that includes across the Northwoods in Vilas, Forest, Lincoln, Langlade, and Price counties. But soon, some of those names will change. U.S. Department of the Interior Secretary Deb Haaland has ordered geographic features with the offensive term to be renamed. For Indigenous women like Allen, that is a big deal.
To at least give hope to the Indigenous women that they mean more than that term.
Federal officials are now seeking ideas from the public for new names for these sites. Allen hopes some can take on the names they were originally given by Indigenous people hundreds of years ago.
It's like we're carrying those messages from our mothers and grandmothers that are no longer here, that have fought so hard back then in more difficult situations, and hopefully they're up there looking down that it's finally getting to this point in time.
It's a point in time that Allen hopes marks a shift so that her newborn granddaughter can grow up in a better world. I'm Erin Gottsacker.
A new medical facility on the Navajo Nation in Arizona is nearly complete. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, it will eventually serve thousands of people on the southwest portion of the vast reservation.
Construction of the 154,000-square-foot Dilkon Medical Center began in 2019. Crews faced setbacks along the way because of shortages of building materials and COVID-19-related supply chain issues. Nonetheless, the facility is set to open this summer, almost 2 years ahead of schedule. The medical center includes isolation rooms that were specially built to separate COVID patients, and the hospital will utilize solar panels and natural lighting to lower energy costs. It'll also include on-site housing to accommodate more than 100 staff members and medical personnel. Tribal leaders, including Navajo President Jonathan Nez, recently toured the facility, which they say is 95% complete. Currently, residents of Dilkon and other surrounding rural communities have to drive 40 minutes to the off-reservation city of Winslow for the nearest medical care. Officials will hold an opening ceremony in July and expect the hospital to begin accepting patients in August. The limited number of medical facilities on the Navajo Nation faced critical staff, bed, and supply shortages during the height of the pandemic, and COVID patients were frequently taken off the reservation for care. At one point in 2020, the tribe had the highest per capita rate of new coronavirus infections in the nation. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Environmental Working Group's 2022 Dirty Dozen Clean 15 report on produce and pesticides is out, and strawberries once again top the Dirty Dozen list. Suzanne Potter has the story.
An annual list of best and worst produce in terms of pesticide residue is out, and strawberries, spinach, kale, and collard and mustard greens top the list. The 2022 Dirty Dozen from the Environmental Working Group also includes nectarines, apples, grapes, peppers, cherries, peaches, pears, celery, and tomatoes. Sydney Swanson with EWG says the data comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture based on 45,000 produce samples.
This year, we did find that over 70% of conventional produce sold in the United States was contaminated with pesticides. While everything tested was within legal limits, we believe that legal does not mean safe.
Farmers say they only apply pesticides approved by the feds. EWG says people should still eat lots of fruits and vegetables, but recommends they choose organic produce. Last year, the Biden administration reinstated an Obama-era ban on the notorious pesticide chlorpyrifos, a ban that was lifted during the Trump years. Swanson says people should wash all fruits and vegetables, but notes the USDA also washes the produce samples before testing them.
The USDA washes them and prepares them the exact same way that a consumer would prepare them at home, and they test it that way. So the pesticide residues that we would be exposed to is the same amount that the USDA is detecting.
The group also publishes a list of produce it calls the Clean 15, on which almost 70% of samples had no detectable pesticide residues. That list includes, starting with the cleanest, avocados, sweet corn, pineapple, onions, papaya, frozen sweet peas, asparagus, honeydew, kiwis, cabbage, mushrooms, cantaloupe, mangoes, watermelon, and sweet potatoes. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael would like more surprises.
I want more positive surprises, like the snow Monday morning and the 78 degrees last Thursday, getting Ketanji Brown Jackson, the country's first black woman Supreme Court justice, approved with yes votes from Manchin and Paul. A mixed surprise was my voter registration card. No idea part of Portland, let alone mine, got moved from Blumenauer to Schrader. State rep is an upgrade, state senator is a toss-up. Know where you are. But after that, no surprises. Same old getting worse. Ukraine war becoming more brutal and hopeless. The climate's increasingly ignored. Four Portland folks shot dead in a week downtown. Why is the right wing so against most rights? The right to choose, the right to vote, yet they're for the right to own guns, the right to tell other people what to do, what to read. Pima Chodron said to leave frugally on surprise, but frugal these times is a good day, and I'm already thin from my BS intolerance, my allergy to processed greed. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Eric Tagadoff, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
To start, would you mind introducing yourself?
My name is Melanie Henshaw. I am the Zuhl Investigative Reporting Fellow for Street Roots.
So you wrote an article for Street Roots this week called "Can't Compete Amid a Tight Housing Market, Investors Snap Up Homes in Record Numbers." It delves into how housing problems in Portland and the metro area is fed by